ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
William Dalrymple counts himself as a lucky man. He spends his days doing exactly the kind of thing that has interested him ever since he was a small boy growing up on the wild, windswept coast of Scotland. This was where William first fell in love with the stories, the characters, and the artifacts of the past, and discovered that he had a talent for writing about them. William's deep curiosity about the world made him a traveller. At just 21, he set off to follow in the footsteps of Marco Polo across the width of Asia all the way to Xanadu. And not long after that adventure, William moved to Delhi, and that's where he's made his home for much of his adult life. Living in India has allowed William to explore the breadth of his interests as a historian, traveller, photographer and curator, and where he's founder and co-director of the Jaipur Literary Festival, which is perhaps the world's largest writers' festival. William is currently on a speaking tour in Australia. Hi, William. Welcome back to Conversations.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me back.
I'd love you to take me back to that place where you grew up in Scotland. What does it look like, or how did it look to you as a small boy?
I had an incredibly blessed childhood in a world that no longer exists, really. It was a kind of tiny Edwardian bubble. I grew up in the sense I had the childhood of someone who might have grown up in sort of 1890 or 1910 in a world that was remarkably unchanged by modernity.
In what ways?
Well, I grew up on a beach in rural Scotland, southeast of Edinburgh. And it was, I mean, it was a, like something out of a Chekhov play or a Turgenev short story or something. The modern world had barely invaded. I mean, we did have a television set, but that was about the only thing that would have differentiated it from the life any of my great-grandparents might have led. I knew people, I went to school normally, but I knew people who had governesses, which, no longer existed in the rest of the world 50 years earlier. My father was in the army, and the attitudes of the kind of people I grew up in were very much those of an Edwardian mindset. And the actual house which I grew up in was enclosed by a beautiful 200-year-old walled garden. It was like something, again, a children's book, Tom's Magic Garden or something. It really felt enclosed from the world, which meant, of course, that when I left that bubble, I had a lot of lessons to learn, and the world now looks completely different from any of the assumptions which I grew up with. But it was a very magical and gorgeous place to grow up, and I was very, very lucky.
Did you have much freedom as a little kid to explore that magical world you were in?
To an extent that would be impossible for a kid today. I was free to walk down to the beach on my own, unsupervised. And I remember by the time, I suppose I was 12 or 13 and able to get on my bike and just set off, going off for 2 or 3 hours on my own or with my brothers or with my friends on bikes and knocking on people's door and asking for lemonade. Do people do that still?
I thought that was only ever in Enid Blyton stories. That was a true thing.
It was very much an Enid Blyton childhood, ridiculously so. My kids, when they hear descriptions of my childhood, even though they, in their early youth, it was still kind of just surviving, and we'd go and stay with their grandparents. They can sort of barely believe this time warp is the best word for it. Yeah,
it's a very lovely part of Scotland, but it has a violent history of witch trials. What happened in your part of Scotland back in the 1590s?
So North Berwick was the place where the witches who ended up in Macbeth lived. It's now a very sort of sweet, small Edwardian former holiday town, now a sort of dormitory town for Edinburgh, connected by a tiny little chuggy railway that takes an hour to make it to Edinburgh. And you couldn't imagine anything less sort of spooky or supernatural. But allegedly, on in about 1600, when King James the First of England and King James the Sixth of Scotland, the same guy, first and sixth, the son of Mary Queen of Scots, was coming back from Denmark. The witches gathered on North Berwick Law and whipped up a terrific storm, after which there was the one of the most famous ever witch trials, and six innocent women were accused of being in league with the devil and meeting him on North Berwick Law and creating this storm. And the king, James I, personally supervised their torture in the most horrific way. And they were all killed in unbelievably vile and horrible ways. And only recently has their history sort of been properly written and their sort of place in history as innocent women accused falsely of all sorts of enormities being corrected. And there's been a great move by the Scottish government over the last 10 years to write this history. Weirdly enough, my brother now lives in the house of one of those witches, or
really?
where one of the witches worked, yeah.
So your family, the Dalrymples, have they been in that part of Scotland all the way back to the 1500s, or what's the history of your family there?
Almost. So my family originated on the west coast in Ayrshire. The name Dalrymple is sort of Norse. The first bit, Dal, is the same word as Dale, as in the Yorkshire Dales. And Rimple means wiggly, so it was a wiggly valley that we came from, which is indeed where the town of Rimple looks like. And they were clever lawyers, and in the late 17th century, early 18th century, they were very powerful and were allied with the English and helped bring about the Union. But were also, I mean, from the perspective of Scottish nationalists today, they were kind of, you know, themselves in league with the devil in a different way. And my direct forebear was a kind of bright young lawyer who moved from the West Coast to Edinburgh, became a Lord President of the Court of Session, which means sort of top lawyer, and bought the gorgeous estate on the beach where I grew up. And so 1695, I think, was the year he moved in there. And so we've been there 300
Once
years.
Once the witches were safely cleared out, your family could make a
move in. Exactly. That's exactly right.
So you yeah. said that there were, you know, friends of yours who had governesses. You didn't, but you did have a nanny. And how did this nanny help get you interested in history on a trip to the local library?
She was extraordinary. She had left school at 16, but I don't know whether this was typical of her generation, but she grew up knowing great chunks of Sir Walter Scott and Robbie Burns by heart. And to this day, I can recite both. Breathe that a man with soul so dead to never to himself and said, this is my own, my native land. And it can go on for another 40 minutes.
So I had this... A warning or an invitation. Yes, okay.
We haven't had Robbie Burns yet. We sleek it, cowering, timorous beastie. Anyway... That was the kind of stuff I grew up with. And my extraordinary nanny, who's still alive, aged 99 now, and who I will send this interview to, was an extraordinary woman, is an extraordinary woman. And she, despite having left school at 16, she was fascinated by history and used to read me tales of Scottish keeps and castles. But also, she was half Irish and had a deep hatred of the English. I had this rather sort of confusing education whereby my parents were very much pillars of the establishment, and my father was the Lord Lieutenant of East Lothian and used to sort of deliver, you know, centenary telegrams by the Queen and this sort of thing. Well, my nanny was kind of...
Sowing dissent.
Was a Fenian, really. I mean, actually, there's no other word for it. And I remember very clearly being taken down to the library in North Berwick and spending hours there while she made me read the... book on the Irish potato famine and the things that the Redcoats did and the Dubonnet Prince Charlie, but particularly the potato famine, because this particular book called The Great Famine had these horrific woodcuts that I can remember to this day with sort of mothers eating their babies and children starving in farmyards. And when, with my podcast, Empire Podcast, we actually did the Irish potato famine, I got the book out, and there were these woodcuts that I remember, you know, branded onto my seven-year-old brain.
That's not standard children's literature, that's for sure. So when you first made a trip to England, William, was it a sort of like entering the cauldron of Satan's cauldron? How did you remember feeling about your southern neighbour?
It was exactly that. It was in the autumn. Again, this is another memory that's branded onto my brain. You know, one forgets so much of one's childhood, but certain things remain. And one of them was this first trip to England. And it was to see one of my nanny's cousins who lived just over the border in Northumberland. They were Scots, but they had somehow chosen to live in England, which was a rare and terrible thing. And anyway, we went to see them. And it was crop burning. And so it was literally like entering Mordor. And as we crossed the border, I remember sort of smoke rising from the fields, as if the English army had just passed. And all the stories that I'd been told about the redcoats burning people's houses down and destroying the local, you know, churches and things was happening then and there. So I literally grew up imagining sort of, you know, the English as ogres that did terrible things.
Well, when it came time for you to be sent off to boarding school in England, how did that strike the young William? You were only eight or so.
So, yeah, this would be only a year later. I think there were two occasions I went to England before going to boarding school. One was the occasion with the crop burning. The other one was to see the Tutankhamun exhibition in the British Museum. And I was, even at that point, crazy about ancient history and archaeology. And it was, I'd exhausted all the museums in Scotland, I think, by this point, but looking at ancient Egyptian mummies and things, which is what I loved, and stories of Howard Carter and the curse of the mummy and all this kind of nonsense. And when the British Museum had this famous Tutankhamun show, it must have been 1971, and I think I must have been 7 years old, and I asked my parents to take me down to the British Museum. And we went and saw Tutankhamun. And again, that's sort of branded on my memory, the first sight of Tutankhamun's golden mummy sitting there in this spotlit case in a dark room. So I suppose that when I was sent off to boarding school was only the third time I'd ever left Scotland. And I'd certainly never been anywhere further.
Were you awfully homesick?
Well, weirdly enough, I mean, this is not something I would do. And I didn't do for my children. I kept my children at home until they were in their teens. And they grew up with me in Delhi and with my wife, and we would never have done this. But at the time, it didn't seem an odd thing because my brothers were already at the school. And it seemed like, you know, promotion. It seemed like the next thing that you did on your journey. And I was homesick, but it wasn't in general an unhappy experience at all. Often you come across people who have very grim memories of English boarding schools. I went to this oddly benign, well, in many ways benign, I should say, Catholic school called Ampleforth, and I went first to the prep school, as it was called, aged eight. But all my brothers were already there. It was something that was already fairly familiar. My housemaster was someone that had been to stay at home ever since my childhood, so I knew him well. And it wasn't frightening or distant or foreign. Mm. Since then, the school has been embroiled, like every Catholic school, in a whole farrago of terrible child abuse stories.
You'd had this access to nature, to the beach and the dales around your home in Scotland. Did you still have that once you were at boarding school?
Even more so. Aberforth was set almost deliberately away from any temptation of any sort. In this gorge, I mean, even more beautiful than home, actually, in the North Yorkshire Moors. And it was a stunningly beautiful and very, very interesting history. And from the age of 13, you were allowed to have a bike, and I got permission from my housemaster to go off and explore. And I went off, usually with friends, sometimes on my own, this little nerd with bicycle clips around his trousers and a sort of sandwich in his backpack.
What were you exploring for?
Well, it sounds ridiculous. At age 13, I wrote a thing on Anglo-Saxon sculpture and published my first
article. It would sound ridiculous for anyone else but you, William Dalrymple, where it sounds absolutely on brand.
My housemaster said at one point that no one he'd ever had in his house had ever changed less than me. I was doing, age 13, exactly what I do now, but on a slightly smaller scale. And I had this fascinating time. And this school, which you know, I think if you'd been a scientist or something, it would have been very frustrating because I don't think it had any of the kind of cutting-edge contemporary education that a scientist would have benefited from. But for the kind of stuff I was interested in, ancient history, theology, literature, the arts, it was an incredibly benign school. And there were these extraordinary teachers who had chosen to live in this very remote and beautiful place. And many of them were writers in their own right and used to, you know, review for the TLS or something like that. And it was a... I think when, you know, you come across Catholic educational institutions in the pages of James Joyce, they're brutal places where the Irish Christian Brothers sort of beat children and forced them to learn the catechism. Going to this school in the 70s and 80s, you know, the 60s had already happened, the Second Vatican Council had taken place. It was actually an incredibly liberal institution. Mm. And behind it were these very learned monks who were genuinely interested in educating kids. And initiating them into, you know, all the stuff I write about now, you know, Islamic history, Byzantium, not Indian history, but certainly the history of the Middle East was stuff that I originally learned at that school. As I said, the school, I think, was deliberately placed in the North Yorkshire Moors because it was miles from any girls' school and in the eyes of its founders was beyond, you know, all possible temptations. What they didn't know was that the playing fields in autumn produced, and the clay soils of this school produced the most spectacular crop of magic mushrooms that we harvested dutifully every September and October, which kept us very busy until the following summer.
It's given a whole new sense of your days at Catholic boarding school,
I discovered psychedelic drugs on a scale and with a richness. And we used to sit there reading The Doors of Perception and Aldous Huxley and experimenting with these things. I should say this was not necessarily a good thing, and some kids did take too many and I've got one artist friend who definitely took too many and is producing very strange sculptures ever since. Boys have ways of finding temptations where none are available.
Indeed they do. So ancient history was your great love as a historian, first off. And where were you planning to head after making it out of school?
So I literally... It sounds ridiculous. It sounds like I'm making it up, but there is an exercise book I've got before I went to my boarding school. So I must have been six or seven, around the time, I suppose, that this Tutankhamun trip took place. And, you know, we were made to write an essay on what you want to do when you grow up. And I want to be an author and an archaeologist, which is kind of boringness, I suppose, what I am. And so, of course, the first thing I wanted to do when I left school was go off and dig Syrian bulls in Iraq. And I actually managed to get a place at the British School of Archaeology in my gap year between school and uni. And just 3 weeks before I was due to set off, and I'd already had all my... I remember I had blood tests and things. I've still got the little thing in a little plastic pouch saying what blood group I am, which I had to have made at that point before going to Iraq. But 3 weeks before, Saddam Hussein closed it down, saying it was a nest of British spies, which it no doubt was. I'd never made it there. My trajectory might have been quite different.
Well, where did fate take you instead that year?
So my best friend had arranged, wasn't into this idea at all, and he'd arranged to go and teach in India. So without any interest in India at all and no plan to sort of explore it or be interested in it, I took what, in a sense, was the default position of just going off with my mate to the Himalayas and found myself, aged 18, teaching Indian history, a subject of which I knew absolutely nothing.
It's like the whole expression of colonialism just there in that sentence, I guess.
Yep.
So people tend to have very strong memories of their first arrival in India. What was yours like?
I can remember this absolutely. I've got a complete snapshot of that evening. The Jewel and the Crown had been on the telly, this sort of 40-part epic sort of story of partition, but with the Paul Scott novels turned into one of the most ambitious BBC dramas ever made, I think. And I arrived in India, and this is literally true. I went to the Army and Navy store, which still existed. I don't know where it's open now, but in those days existed in Edinburgh, and bought myself a pair of khaki shorts because I thought that's what everyone wore.
Hopefully not a pith helmet.
Not a pith helmet, but I'm sure if it had been available, I probably would have bought it. And instead arrived, of course, in midwinter in Delhi. It was the 26th of January, 1984, and there was thick mist outside the terminal building. And everyone was swathed in blankets. The flight arrived sort of 2 in the morning or 11 o'clock at night, you know, middle of the dark, cold winter night. And I'd been expecting, you know, beating sun and sort of, I suppose, people in pith helmets strutting around still, because I'd been watching this series. Instead, it was, you know, modern Delhi with blankets and freezing cold and a completely different world. And then we went straight up into the Himalayas, which in midwinter was very cold.
You also did some volunteering work with Mother Teresa on that trip. What are your memories of that?
So this job in the Himalayas, it turned out was that we'd actually taken somebody else's job. So it was slightly awkward. And after a month, we resigned and just went travelling. And there followed, in a sense, I think one of the two or three, if I, you know, was allowed to replay any bits of my life, it'd be one of the bits I'd definitely choose. This extraordinary discovery of India, just as a, you know, as lots of kids do every year, you know, with a backpack and a very low budget. We had 30 rupees a day was our budget.
And what did that buy you? What did you see on that first exploration?
But you only one meal a day. So you had bananas and then you were allowed one meal. The lowest grade of hotel, which in some places was really, really very, very basic. We couldn't afford hotels 7 nights a week, so we had to travel on buses, on night buses, in order to have the money to make it to the south of India. But it was completely magical. And at the end of it, when we'd run out of money and didn't have anything, couldn't really travel anymore because we didn't have the cash for it, we managed to get a berth in a Mother Teresa home. As part of our effort to stay on in India and work for 3 months at a home for the dying, which at that point I was still a very sort of pious little Catholic boy, fresh from Catholic boarding school. And I suppose we were kind of young and idealistic. We wanted to, you know, do something for India.
That's a very intense kind of volunteer work for someone, especially so young. Is that stayed with you, that experience in any way?
It was quite intense. I mean, you know, what the nuns did was they went out in rickshaws and they picked up people from the streets of Delhi, which in those days, you know, were often full of people dying in the streets. And they brought them to the nursing home and about half of them did die. And so aged 18, well, actually I was 19 by that stage. By my 19th birthday, I was moving corpses quite regularly and seeing, you know, bodies decaying in the heat and that kind of stuff, which was quite intense. But also it felt something that was a worthy thing to do, and the sort of thing which I suppose my education had brought me up to think was a sort of ideal. And that was in the morning, and in the afternoon we didn't have any work, so we were free to go out and explore Delhi, and used to take the bus down to southern Delhi, where I now live, and go and explore the extraordinary richness of all the Mughal and Sultanate remains that fill for miles and miles and miles around Delhi, are these extraordinary ruins, which even today are sort of barely studied and written about. And that was where I fell in love with Delhi. And it was, you know, eventually became my second book, City of Jinns.
Well, after this gap year, you went off to study at Cambridge. And then what opportunity did you spot on a notice board in your second year?
Yeah, this is very lucky. So I got into Trinity College, Cambridge, which is the biggest college in Oxbridge, actually. It's a huge, great, big sort of mega college. And I remember one day coming out of hall after lunch and seeing this notice on the notice board, and it was the Gaillard Lapsley Travelling Scholarship for Medieval Historians. And I knew there were only about 10 medieval historians in college, so I thought it was quite a good chance that this was something that I might get. So I went literally to the library, which was just beside the hall, got out the Times Atlas of World History and tried to work out what was the longest medieval journey I could apply for. And
that was your criteria, length.
For the largest. That was literally the criteria. And it was done in an hour without much thought. And, of course, the longest journey in this edition of the Times Atlas of World History was Marco Polo's journey to China. So I duly sort of more or less copied out the entry on the Times Atlas of World History, typed it up, sent it in, forgot about it. Did my exams, and then under the door of my room on the last day of term, this envelope was shoved under. I remember opening it, and there was a cheque for £750, which in those days was more or less, I suppose, you know, like getting a 10,000 quid cheque today. It was an enormous sum of money, and I'd never had money like that to spend on travelling. and planned this trip. And then, you know, suddenly the kind of penny dawned that this sort of, you know, wild idea that I'd merrily put together without much thought, I now actually was committed to do, or I'd just have to give the money back, which I had no intention of doing, being a good Scotsman.
Off you were going. Did you do much planning before it? I mean, how much of the logistics of a trip like that could you organise before you set off?
Well, it needed a lot of planning because places like Pakistan and China and Syria and so on needed visas. A lot of the countries in the Middle East were at war with each other, so you had to find a way to go, for example, from Israel to Syria. The answer was to take a boat to Cyprus and then come back into Syria. And so it needed a lot of planning, but it wasn't alone in this, because I had this sort of formidable friend who I barely knew, who'd also wanted to do this trip and who had decided to come along for the first half of the trip. And this was a woman called Laura Wade Geary, who was this sort of odd mix of sort of Boadicea and Joyce Grenfell in one very neat package. And she was the daughter of the High Commissioner in India, who I'd met at the end of my time in India, and actually had picked me up from the Home for the Dying in her father's sort of grand limousine. So having been living in this rubbish dump, literally, it was on the edge of the municipal rubbish dump and moving bodies around for 3 months, ended up being picked up by this enormous sort of old-style limo and spending 2 days in this kind of gorgeous house where she lived. And we remained friends. And she was this extraordinary figure. She had already travelled the world, was much more worldly wise and organised than I was. And in due course, she would go on to run Marks & Spencer and make a fortune.
You're kidding.
I think she's got a title now. You know, she's been a...
That's a great person to have organising your visas and your other travel logistics.
She was extraordinary. And I've never been good at that side of stuff. And to this day, kind of, you know, need help from my kids these days.
So, William, you set off at age 21 with a grant from your college at Cambridge to retrace Marco Polo's footsteps across the width of Asia. These countries, Syria, Pakistan, China, I mean, as a baby historian, what an extraordinary opportunity to witness a world that was going to change so radically in the decades and so since.
Exactly. I mean, it was the most glorious experience. And if I had one thing to relive, it would be that. It was this completely magical, eye-opening trip.
The whole trip or one section in particular?
Well, the whole trip was extraordinary. But if I had one section, I suppose it would be actually a country which doesn't have very romantic connotations today, but Pakistan. Mm. We were the first set of foreign tourists allowed up the Kunjarab Highway, the Karakoram Highway through the Kunjarab Pass. And it's one of the most, I mean, still to this day, I think it's the most beautiful place I've ever been in my life.
What does it look like? I mean, it's so unknown for most of us.
It's, you know, the Himalayas on benzene. It's spectacular mountains, snow-capped peaks, valley, lost valleys with sort of amazing green paddy fields and mulberry orchards and apricot orchards. Utterly, utterly beautiful and magical, and at that stage, completely unexplored. And it was like sort of going into Narnia or something. It was something beyond anything we'd imagined or could have dreamt of. And this whole trip, I had already by this stage begun. This was the period when travel writing was really considered to be, you know, the hip, brilliant way of writing nonfiction. And writers like Bruce Chatwin, who I know has a very mixed reputation in Australia, but was a hero to me when I was growing up. And Eric Newby and Paul Theroux, Jonathan Raeburn were, you know, at the peak of their popularity and their prestige. They were winning prizes everywhere. And so I'd read a lot of this sort of travel literature. The Grant of Travel issue had sold a million copies or something. It was considered to be the hip new way of dealing with the world in a literary form. And I just started taking notes with a view to writing a book. And when I came back, was able to get a contract with a publisher, age 21.
And that's your first book in Xanadu, which was hugely popular and established you as a writer. How do you feel about that book now?
With a complete horror.
Really?
And in fact, And in fact, I've written a sort of health warning on the I think it's with the Indian edition, hasn't yet reached the British edition, but a couple of years ago. Because it is this deeply embarrassing book that is sort of channeling 1930s, the colonial travel writing, two generations too late. The book, I'd say, still sells, and I get nice letters about it, and people think it's funny. But it's
Well, how would you write it differently now? That same travel.
I absolutely would write it completely differently. I mean, it is. I as I said, I grew up in this sort of slightly Edwardian bubble, which I had yet entirely to free myself from, and it has all the confidence and blinkered. Actually, not blinkered nationalism, but sort of, there's a whole set of sort of colonial preconceptions that are evident in that book, which I had yet to shed myself of. But it is also, I think, my funniest book. And there are jokes which still work. And occasionally I read, very carefully selected passages from it when I'm asked to read from my travel writing. But
the fact that you and your partner Olivia went off and lived in Delhi not long after, I mean, I guess that's got to have an enormous impact on the way someone sees the world. The fact that you were living in the place that you were writing about or in a different centre of the world than the one you'd grown up in, that just alone must have shifted the way you understood history.
I'm sure that is exactly the answer. It did change. Living in India for 40 years and seeing the effects of colonialism and gradually understanding what the British did to India, which was not something which I got straight away, was unquestionably what changed me as a historian and has turned me into the historian that I am today. And there was no one sort of blinding moment of sort of road to Damascus. But gradually living in India over 40 years and bringing up my kids there and seeing them grow up in that world. Yeah, no, I mean, it was an education in itself.
What did the Indians make of you moving in, William, you and Olivia? What did the locals think of you? Were there many other British expats then at the sort of late 80s, early 90s?
In that period, there were probably fewer Brits living in India than at any other point since, the Elizabethan period. There's now a massive British community out there all going out for work to find opportunities for employment. And there's this annual event at the British High Commission in Delhi, the Queen's birthday party, where, these days about 5,000 people turn up. And there's all these stalls of all these sort of British companies selling whiskey and gin and all the other things, and they all lay out their wares. In those days, I remember the British community was called in when the first Gulf War broke out because there were security threats against us. And I think, at the very max, there was 75 of us probably at that point in Delhi. Because there were no economic opportunities and there was no and the old colonial sort of, hangers-on had died already. And so it's that period between those two worlds, the end of the colonial period and before the rise of the new India. And there was no one else out there. It was a very small, of those 75, I suppose, half were British Indians. So it was a fascinating time to be there.
Who were your friends? Who were you and Olivia friendly with? What world were you moving in?
Two groups of friends. We had the other foreign correspondents because that's what I was doing. I was writing for the Sunday Times and the Spectator and the New Statesman, and was cutting my teeth as a journalist in my day life. But also had very much a pool of Indian writer and journalist and sort of designery friends who are still my mates now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've been living there 40 years, so I'm very lucky to have two different worlds and. They're as different from each other as they can imagine. I've got my London world, and I'm there in the summer, May, June, July, living in this tiny little terraced house in Chiswick. And then we have this rather grander life, 9 months of the year on a farm in Delhi, in a goat farm. I'm a goat farmer.
Of all your accolades, I can't believe I didn't start with that. William Dalrymple, well-known goat farmer.
It is very much the case. I make goat cheese. It's not a toy farm, but it's not a big commercial enterprise. But it does chug away, and it's a very very nice place to live. We've got this sort of we rent this gorgeous farm on the edge of town, And we sort of ploughed up the lawns that were, it was a suburban villa, and we've actually turned it into a farm. Farm in the Delhi sense normally means a suburban villa with a swimming pool. But we've actually made it into a farm. We have bees and we have goats and we have enough vegetables to feed, I think, the three neighbouring villages because we plant about 1,000 cauliflowers every year. We can't eat more than, even if we really try and eat cauliflower every single day, we probably can't manage more than about 50. And the other 950 go somewhere, which is definitely not to our table.
So India was this place that you discovered your, or made your adult life in and raised your family in. But as time went on, you discovered all of these family connections to
Correct.
This place. First of all, your father. Tell me about your father's connection with India and how you discovered that.
Well, that actually, funny enough, it sounds ridiculous, but that was one of the last connections that I really discovered. My first connection was I knew that I had these fascinating great-grandmother and her sisters who were quite famous because one of them was this photographer, Julie Margaret Cameron, who was the first great woman photographer and used to photograph people like Darwin and Tennyson.
Virginia Woolf as well.
Virginia Woolf was her niece part. So this world in between, you know, the Pre-Raphaelites, which was that generation, and then the Bloomsbury group, which was their children and grandchildren. But when I went to India, there were all these names that turned up, including the Princep family, who also, of course, play a role in Australian history, not in as quite a benign way as they do in Indian history. And James Princep, who was a great-great uncle, was the guy who translated the Kharoshthi script and rediscovered, really, the ancient history of India, which had been lost. The Emperor Ashoka, the early history of Indian Buddhism, the Kushan dynasties. And was this very important figure. And as I read Indian history, I began to realise that my own family had this connection to it. And when I came to write a book called White Mughals, which was rather later, published around, I think, 2002, in the course of research that I discovered I had not only Mughal ancestors on my direct paternal line, but also Bengali Hindu ancestors from a great-great-grandmother. Which kind of made sense of why I'd become so obsessed with India if I actually had all this,
had those
this
stories
Indian
been
DNA
kept in the family passed on at all? Or this was something that just
totally
turned
lost.
Up through your research?
Totally lost, except for the fact that this rather glamorous great-great-grandmother wore Indian clothes and Indian bracelets and had very dark Indian skin and eyes.
So when you say lost, it would have been hidden, do you think,
yeah,
more?
Correct. Correct. And so, I mean, it wasn't very difficult to locate it. There was a stash of family papers that I think my great-grandfather had given to the National Archives in Edinburgh. And it had all been catalogued. And just one day in there, I discovered this will from a guy called James Dalrymple, who had married Muti Begum, who was the Mughal Empress Nur Jahan's great-great-niece. And that this couple, James and Muti Begum, had a set of children of whom the boys were, in the words of the letters in the will, fair enough to escape detection. And so were sent back to Scotland and did the things, you know, Scots toffs do, like playing golf and shoot pheasants. And their sister, who was Nur Begum, was brought up a Shia Muslim and married to a Subedar because she was too dark to escape detection. And we wouldn't know about this, but for the fact that she runs out of money later in life when she's widowed and writes to her brother now in Scotland saying, this is your sister. And she writes in Persian and has some letter writer in the bazaar translate it over it into English. So here was a brother and sister who'd lost touch with each other so much that they didn't have a written language in common, but who the letter was kept, so I presume it was answered. It wasn't thrown away or shoved into the fire.
So this is way back in the 18th century. Moving forward to your own father's story, what connections were there then?
Well, my dad I knew had been at partition, and I knew a few details. It wasn't like it was a kind of family secret, but it just wasn't something he wanted to talk about. And
why was he at partition?
He was a young soldier. He came out of school just as the war was ending and got sent over to as it happened, oversee, you know, be one of the troops who was there handing over power to India and Pakistan at the birth of the new nations in 1947. And he was what was called an ADC, an aide-de-camp to one of the great generals of the period, Frank Musservi. So after he died, the night before his funeral, my son Sam, who's a historian too, and has just published his first book on partition called Five Partitions, Shattered Lands, The Five Partitions of India is the full title. Sam sort of raided my father's study, which had always been slightly sort of out of bounds. It was where, you know, it was his den where he used to sit. And in a locked cupboard, but the key was in the lock, were these scrapbooks, which I'd never seen. And we opened them up, and there were these extraordinary photographs and sort of memorabilia from this time, including my father sitting as a 18 or 19 year old at Lord Mountbatten's Silver Jubilee, because his boss, Frank Musservi, was one of the guests. So he was at the dinner at the same table as Nehru, Mrs. Gandhi, Sardar Patel, all the, you know, the great freedom fighters that brought India's independence. And this was something my father had simply never talked about.
Even after you've moved to India and made a career writing about India, he hadn't mentioned this to you.
He hadn't come out to visit, and he was, and I'd always said I wanted to record him on this, and he'd always put it off and said, you know, I'll do it one day, and then he died, and we hadn't got it. I really had tried, but yeah, I do sort of slightly kick myself for not having pushed a bit harder. It was something he clearly didn't want to talk about, and partition was obviously, you know, one of the great horrors of modern history. 1.5 million people died, including many people he knew. And one little thing he did say was he put all his bearers and assistants onto the train in Rawalpindi. They were Hindu and they had to go to India, and they never made it. They were one of those many people in those horror stories of trains being stopped halfway and raiders getting into the trains and killing everybody in a sea of blood, in those blood on the tracks.
So it wasn't a history he wanted to go back to. That makes
so I
sense.
Think that that's how Sam and I have interpreted it. That he just stuff that he saw horrors. It was like, you know, the Indian equivalent of opening the death camps in Nazi Germany at the same sort of time, 1945, 46, 47. These were the post-war periods when all these horrors either took place or were discovered. And yeah, I think it must have been very traumatic for him, because he was a loving dad, and you know, he was always there. You know, my school events and so on, never missed any of them, but he would not come out to India to see us.
Was he anxious about you and, you know, his grandchildren living there?
No, he was very good. I mean, although he was, you know, a man very much of his generation, pillar of the establishment, Sword of Honour at Sandhurst, all that sort of package of things, he never pushed. There were four boys, of which I was the youngest. He never pushed us to follow in his footsteps or be a soldier like him. And I think a lot of what we all did must have been rather alien to him. My brother up for me is a designer. You know, these were not worlds that he was familiar with. But he was very good about letting us do our own thing. And I think particularly, his father had inherited a complete financial catastrophe from his father. And my dad had grown up very sort of careful with money. I mean, he wasn't hard up, but he didn't, you know, we didn't go on fancy holidays abroad. We didn't have wine at meals, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think that he must have been very concerned when I said I wanted to be a writer or an archaeologist, neither of which, you know, really had income streams attached to them in his head, I'd have thought. But he was very good at letting me do that. And then when I, you know, wanted to move to India, he was very happy to do that, allowed us to go and didn't put obstacles in our way. But no, he was very benign, but he just would not come out and see us and made a whole variety of different excuses over many years.
As you found out, you know, these different facts about your own family's connection to India, has that changed the way, the sort of sense you have of the history of this place? You know, how does that little tiny biographical story of your family, how does it sit within the bigger stories of India that you've told?
Well, I think anyone anywhere in the world wants to believe that their family and their nation are always on the right side of history. And it's a natural impulse. Whatever country you're born into, you assume that you are the good guys. And certainly the story when I was growing up was that, you know, the British had defeated fascism, stopped the Holocaust, opened the death camps, fought for freedom and democracy. And the darker story, that there are, in fact, only 22 countries in the world that the British have not invaded at some point or another, and that every 6 days somewhere in the world celebrates independence from Britain. These were facts which, you know, amazingly, were slow to dawn on my generation, I think, because we very much grew up with that propaganda that we were bringing democracy and goodness and civilization to the world. And it's really only in my 20s that I begin to see things are more complicated. And by the time that I began work on my quartet of books on the East India Company, the first one was White Mughals, then The Last Mughal, Return of a King, and The Anarchy. These four books on East India Company history, I was sufficiently well-educated and well-travelled enough to see the wider perspective. And so my adult life has been spent writing about colonialism in a very different way to the way I understood it when I was growing up.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about the little boy who fell in love with history and the great Egyptian discoveries and Carter, and imagining that as your version of what a historian would be. What's it been like for you in reality compared to the little boy scribbled in his exercise book, "Yes, I want to be an archaeologist and a writer"?
So I think my younger self would have been astonished that I ended up spending 20 years writing about the 18th century, which I would have regarded as modern history as a teenager. And I think I would have been very surprised by what I ended up choosing to write about. And it's only with this new book, The Golden Road, that I've, in a sense, gone back to the stuff that really intrigued me as a child, ancient history. And it was lovely doing it. It was a lockdown book, The Golden Road. I began work when all the libraries and archives were closed and we were locked down on the farm in India, which I have to say was a lovely place to be locked down. I couldn't think of a nicer place to be locked down. There was room to roam and the goats and vegetables, fresh vegetables in the garden and all that sort of stuff. So it was a wonderful place to be based.
What part of the world has its hold on your interest, imagination, exploration right now?
Well, I have to say that the whole horrors that the Palestinian people are going through at the moment, and particularly the people of Gaza, have upset me very much. One of the books we haven't talked about was a Middle Eastern book I wrote in the late 90s called From the Holy Mountain, which was about the Middle Eastern Christians. And one of the subjects I dealt with there was the whole business of the Palestinian Christian community, which people, I think, often assume the Palestinians are all Muslim. In actual fact, traditionally, they're about 20% Christian. And they are the descendants, indeed, of the first Christians who have been sitting in their churches and living in their villages on the West Bank and across Israel-Palestine since the time of Christ. And I've spent a lot of time in the West Bank recording the history of the Palestinians and writing journalism on their plight. And seeing what's happened in Gaza has put me straight back into that world. And my most recent project with the podcast has been a 11-part history of Gaza, right back to the beginning of recorded time. And I thought I knew this history intimately, but I had no idea the antiquity of the Palestinian people. And, you know, everyone knows that quote by the Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, that there's no such thing as Palestinians. In reality, as a historian, I now know, which I didn't know until recently, that the first recorded reference to the Palestinians is in 1483 BC, the Thutmose III, the pharaoh, recording the invasion of the delta by people he calls the Peleset. After that, you get the Assyrians recording their battles against people they call the Palashtu. And then the father of history, Herodotus, latecomer of 400 BC, records the southern coast as being, in his words, Syria Palestina, which is where we get our word Palestine from. And so this is a very ancient people who have been on this land. I mean, the name Palestine predates, I imagine, the place named Britannia. It's one of the oldest place names in the world and one of the oldest toponyms, and they've always been in the sources since the time of Thutmose III, a people associated with that place name. And DNA now shows very clearly that the Palestinians have the same DNA as the Bronze Age inhabitants of the land from that period. So it seems to me that there is a very important project which needs to be amplified, writing a history of the Palestinians in a way that's very simple and accessible for people to read and understand. That there have been in the Eastern Mediterranean, like you'd expect all over Mediterranean, but particularly in the Levant, hugely mixed populations, that it is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious place with many different peoples passing through. And the Palestinians have in their blood Canaanites, Philistines, Byzantines, Greeks, Romans, Crusaders, Arabs, Ottomans. They didn't arrive in the 7th century, as Benjamin Netanyahu is fond of saying. They are a mix of the many peoples who have passed through this area, and many of them are converts from Judaism, so they're cousins of the Israelis. And I do feel very strongly that the Palestinian people have been airbrushed from history as much as, you know, Trotsky was airbrushed from Stalinist photographs, that they have been disappeared actively. And in a sense, you can totally understand where the Israelis are coming from, you know, fleeing the Holocaust or the horrors that the Jewish people have suffered over centuries. But you cannot simply remove an entire people and ethnically cleanse them and erase them from the map and from history. And I think it's a very important job at the moment for the history of the Palestinians to be stated neutrally in a scholarly fashion, without bias, but firmly establishing their roots in this land in a way that is still not understood by most people, I believe.
William, it's been such a pleasure to have you on Conversations. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
Historian William Dalrymple was my guest on Conversations today, and William is currently in Australia on a speaking tour. His most recent book is called The Golden Road, and the history podcast he co-hosts is called Empire. This conversation was produced by Jen Leake and was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.